What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
How fast are they?
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh. Say again.
Their clock must work a little differently than yours, Josh.
Yeah, that's a slow T-Rex, I gotta say.
Jurassic Park and its T-Rexes arrived in theaters on June 11, 1993. By Labor Day, the summer of 93 had also seen the release of The Fugitive, Sleepless in Seattle, In the Line of Fire, and Mike Myers' So I Married an Axe Murderer.
An intriguing mix, but does that qualify summer 93 as one of the best movie seasons of all time? We'll find out this week as we share our top five movie summers.
Spoiler, 93 is not one of the best movie summers of all time. I lived it.
Seconded. Ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. Diligent critic that you are, Josh, you have seen both Pixar's Lightyear and Baz Luhrmann's Elvis. Lightyear opened last weekend. Elvis comes to theaters this weekend. I know you're going to get into all the details of both films later in the show, but for now, just tell me. Given my Baz Luhrmann allergy, I've tried to have it cured, and there's nothing. Zyrtec doesn't cut it. Should I stay away from Elvis?
The answer was yes before I saw Elvis, and it's doubly so after having seen Elvis. So yeah, Adam, Okay. Just spare us all your thoughts on Elvis, please.
I can't wait. More of Josh's thoughts on Elvis and Lightyear later in the show. But first, a top five I am really excited about. It's our top five movie summers coming at really the perfect time, Josh, as we are coming off, as we tape this, one of the best weekends, certainly in recent memory and maybe ever in Chicago, right? Just gloriously sunny and 70 and
pretty nice.
Breezy, just perfect. And even today, I just got back from taking the kids to the pool for the first time. So I am primed and ready to go.
Yeah, we've been hitting the pool too. And it was funny. Saturday was so gorgeous here in Chicago. And yet, of course, what do we still do? We capped it off at the end of the day with a movie. We joked about it. We said we went as a family to see Hello Dolly at the Music Box's 70 millimeter festival. It was so beautiful. Why are we going to sit inside? But, you know, when you love movies, that's how you end a gorgeous summer day.
Mm-hmm. Now, I am actually really pumped about this top five, partly because it's one of my secret favorite types of top fives, which is ironic because here we are talking about art and we like to think of ourselves at least a little bit as creative types. I love spreadsheet top five.
Oh, yeah. This is right up your alley.
I hate math, and yet I love spreadsheets, and I love being able to look at all the movie titles and years next to each other and make my assessment.
And here's how our brains are wired differently. That's absolutely the right way to do it. Much more efficient, way better approach. I don't want to be anywhere near a spreadsheet, so I'm using the old-fashioned Google Doc for this thing. It's completely ungainly, but that's where I'm more comfortable. So no spreadsheet for me, but I knew that's how you'd do it.
Well, that is how I started too, with the ungainly Google Doc, and I realized I needed something more potent. Now, I'm just neurotic enough to have considered going the extra mile and actually assigning a numerical ranking to every film and seeing how the average came out. And I suppose I was just too lazy for that, Josh. It didn't happen.
Did you create an advisory board out of listeners of some sort to consult and make sure every decision you were making, every slot in the spreadsheet looked okay? Did you do that?
I did not do that. Our mechanisms for forming our lists a little bit different. I don't know how different our criteria can be. We'll find that out here in a moment. Did we at least align on, and we touched on this briefly in our Film Spotting Slack, we limited ourselves, right? Going back to 75?
That
really
sounds
the
right.
Summer,
yeah.
The summer that everyone kind of points to as the season where the whole notion of the blockbuster summer really began, of course, with Steven Spielberg's Jaws.
Yeah, that's what I did. Absolutely. Jaws was kind of the foundational moment that we identified.
Let's jump in then. Tell us about your list and give us your number five.
At number five, I didn't have to go back to the 70s, didn't have to go back to the 80s or the 90s, Adam. Here is a relatively recent movie summer in my number five slot. It's 2008. Now, I gave each year, each pick here, something of a subtitle, something that jumped out to me as why this particular summer stood out. And I'm calling this one, 2008, the summer of superheroes. So yeah. The big one you've got, The Dark Knight. I mean, maybe in the conversation for best superhero movie of all time. This is one we revisited on the show a couple of years ago and both thought it stood up. And so you've got The Dark Knight there right at the top. You've also got this same year, Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr. kicking off the MCU, essentially. I look at my ranking, my MCU ranking list on Letterboxd, Adam. It's my number six MCU film. Now, I will nod to those who think the MCU has ruined cinema. This is obviously not going to count towards a great movie summer for you. I get that. But as someone who thinks more often than not, these are decent, entertaining, well-done films, that is to its credit, to the summer of 2008's credit. And so I've got those two superhero movies at the top. Could you call WALL-E a superhero, though, Adam?
I wondered if you would go there, and I don't want to steal any of your thunder, but before you said Iron Man, I thought you might go Philippe Petit for my beloved Man on Wire, kind of a superhero pulling off the feat of walking between the two towers back in the 70s.
It's another credit to that movie, Summer. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Maybe superhero. I think WALL-E probably a little bit more of a superhero for me, though. And I look at my Pixar ranking, I've got WALL-E at number four. So if you put those as the two best movies of the summer for me, The Dark Knight and WALL-E, that's quite a 1-2 punch. As I said, I think Iron Man is one of the stronger MCU films. And then let me throw a couple other titles out that came out. Some great comedy you had in this summer. Kung Fu Panda, another animated effort I liked quite a bit. Tropic Thunder, fantastic. I mean, I want to see Ben Stiller back in that mode in some way. Again, Step Brothers, my kind of Adam McKay movie. He was still making those just straight out hilarious comedies. Mm-hmm. And then you had Pineapple Express as well. Who knows how well that one holds up? Maybe not so well if I were to revisit it. But at the time, sort of the perfect zone out summer comedy that I thought worked quite well.
It's been 2 months you've been coming to me, right?
What's up with the suit?
I'm a process server.
You're a servant? Like a butler?
No. I serve out like subpoenas. I gotta wear like disguises sometimes.
Disguise? Wish I had an easy job like you have.
You have the easiest job on earth. You smoke all day.
I know we don't like to talk about Woody Allen anymore.
But Vicky Cristina's good.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona is good. And it's sort of in that phase where he was making Match Point. And there was another one that came out not too long after Vicky Cristina that I'm forgetting that was decent as well. Even as someone who's been a Woody Allen skeptic really my whole life, there are some of his early films I recognize are quite good, but I've been pretty skeptical of him. I do think Vicky Cristina Barcelona is a really strong film. So I credit the summer of 2008 with that one as well. Quick note here from a listener, got great responses from listeners on social media about their favorite movie summers. And this one came from Brendan Cassidy, who's at Brendan J. Cassidy on Twitter. 2008 first comes to mind between The Dark Knight, WALL-E, Iron Man, Hellboy 2. Another one that I did like, and Speed Racer, Brendan throws in there at the end. I wish I could say I was one of the cool folks who liked Speed Racer at the beginning. I was not, have not revisited it since, so I
those
can't
say. Those people are not cool.
I can't say I'm trying to be cool now, but some, you know, some folks would say that also was a highlight of 2008. I don't need it, though, for 2008 to be my number five pick.
Okay. Is Blue Jasmine maybe the other Woody Allen film you were thinking about?
It isn't, though. I know people
some decent acclaim a few years later.
I know people do like that one as well. I wasn't quite as high on it.
I wasn't either, but that is neither here nor there. 2008, actually a perfect transition, Josh, into my top five because I strongly considered it. Really did take it down just to the final cut, and it ended up being an honorable mention, and here's why. For me, when I talk about that spreadsheet, I had a cutoff. And that cutoff was, fittingly for film spotting, the top five. I thought of these summers in terms of those big five titles and really visualizing it even as kind of a movie poster. If you were looking at a collage of the year and it was comprised of the best five films of that year, which summers then really started to emerge as elite? In 2008 came close, but for me, it didn't have that clear number five. I had Dark Knight and Iron Man and Man on Wire, of course, and Wall-E. And you mentioned a lot of other really good titles, but there just wasn't a clear number five for me the way there was with some of my other movie years. So that poster approach is really what drove my thinking. And I wonder how much of a factor this will be as we get through our lists. We are children of the 80s, and I'm sure, like me, you tried very hard to be as objective as possible, whatever that means. Go back and look at these titles all through the lens of 10, 20, 30, 40 years, whatever it's been since these movies came out, and be realistic about how you value them. And yet, of the 47 summers we considered, I had 12 that made my initial cut based on the movie poster approach. And of those 12, 7 were from the 80s, Josh.
I mean, that makes sense, and yeah. We'll see how many I have as the list shakes out. I do like the poster idea. I think that helped me distinguish between my number two and number one, that sort of thinking. How much weight do I give a single fantastic movie that happened to come out over the summer compared to a handful that maybe mm-hmm. none of them individually are as good, but as a pack,
yeah,
you know, they do make that summer. It's probably something that doesn't bear out in each of my picks as I'm looking at them now, but it did help me make that distinction at the top.
Yeah, and occasionally for me, depth was a factor too, even beyond the top five as we get through the list. But I did want to comment on the 80s part of it, because at first I was looking at these lists and I'm thinking, man, these 2000s and 2010 summers are just brutal. And then I realized, of course, that not only in the 80s were we at our most impressionable, it's the time when film cast its greatest spell over us, even if we didn't maybe blossom into full-blown cinephiles until a decade later, as is true for me. I look back now and I realize how much of an impact those films had on me. And of course, then I had to step outside myself, Josh, and realize that it's probably going to be the same for a lot of our younger listeners who are going to look back at the titles in some cases we're talking about, and they're going to dismiss those the same way I'm dismissing movies from the 2000s or the 2010s, and they're going to really value them. In short, my John Hughes is probably their Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter definitely is going to have that sort of impact. Or go back to the MCU. I mean, mm-hmm. how many, you know, we joke about the 90s kids, the 2010s kids or whatever you call them might point to, looking back when they're older, a summer when there were two MCU movies that they absolutely loved, were formative for them in the same way in igniting their excitement about going to the movies. And I can see that being the case down the road. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. My number five movie summer is not an 80s summer, but it is close. We got to the end of one of the best, if not the best, decade for cinema ever, the 1970s. And in 1979, here's what the movie poster looks like. And I know one of these won't resonate with you, Josh, but for audiences at the time, the movie mattered. And even for audiences like me who caught up with it a few years later and still like it now, it does round out the top five nicely. You've got 1979, Apocalypse Now, number one. Or, if you're so inclined, you could go Alien, number one. That right there makes summer 79 one of those summers that you just almost want to imagine yourself going back in time, walking into the theater, unsuspecting, having no idea what Coppola is up to with Apocalypse Now, maybe heard some of the horror stories about its making and people dropping out and all the money he's spending, but really not having a sense of its reputation at that point. Obviously, you're not coming to it with a certain perspective as we did later, and experiencing Apocalypse Now, experiencing Ridley Scott's Alien. And then if those movies maybe felt, I don't know, a little bit oppressive, a little bit too much to take in, you could wash that down with The Muppet Movie.
I'm Statler.
I'm Waldorf. We're here to heckle a Muppet movie.
Gentlemen, that's straight ahead. Private screening room D.
Private screening?
Yeah, they're afraid to show it in public.
Oh! Oh, look at this place. What a dump.
Bunch of weirdos around here. Look at them.
How great of a family comedy is that film? And another great comedy, my number four from that year, Monty Python's The Life of Brian. Finally, for me, I've got it at five, but other people might have it even higher, the follow-up to Rocky. Rocky and Apollo Creed doing battle again in Rocky II. That top five was the reason why 79 made my list, and there's a few others. Meatballs. You get Bill Murray really planting himself on the movie map in that Ivan Reitman summer comedy, Breaking Away. Another, like Meatballs, great teen movie from the decade. And there was a lot of horror, and most of it I haven't seen, but I'm going to go ahead and throw a nod to the people who may have actually seen these films back in the theater in 79. You've got Amityville Horror, not so good, but was actually the number one film at the box office that year. I think I saw on Rotten Tomatoes, it was the last time a horror movie ever topped the box office.
28 days after the Lutz family moved into their dream house, they were running for their lives. What happened to them is an experience in terror you will never forget. And you will believe in the Amityville Horror.
You also had Phantasm, and you had Cronenberg's The Brood. And, you know, if you were a Bond fan, you got to go see Moonraker. I could also throw in, but I don't think you'll let me count it, that they re-released Jaws in 1979.
No, I don't think we're going to allow that, Adam. That's the sort of cheating is just beyond the pale.
Fair enough.
I'm with you. I'm with you on this pick. I'm with you enough that 1979 is my number four, because this is really a summer of masterpieces when you look at it. You already named, I think, what are the two most people would agree are masterpieces, Apocalypse Now and Alien. I'm going to say it. The Muppet Movie is a masterpiece as well. And I love how you characterized it as a chaser. Because, yeah, that was one other thing to consider when it comes to these movies. What feel like summer movies, right? Generally comedies, big action, that sort of stuff. Alien has its action, but it doesn't really feel like a summer action movie to me. Apocalypse Now absolutely does not have that summer vibe to it. But then you have The Muppet Movie coming along and balancing that out a little bit. So those three really were the reasons why it ended up here at number four. Apocalypse Now, when we did our, I think it was in 2012, our Sight and Sound inspired list, best of all time. We did a 10 and then we did a second 10. For me, Apocalypse Now was in that second 10. So it's in my top 20 of all time. You get a movie like that out in a summer, you have to consider it for this list. Yes, Rocky II is not going to be a credit to me as much as Moonraker. I mean, you've got Roger Moore, possibly at his cheesiest. My favorite Bond. Loved that when it came out as a kid. I probably caught up with it a couple years later on VHS or something like that. But yeah, Moonraker definitely is a reason why 1979 is on my list at number four.
I will be curious to see how much more overlap we have, Josh. And for the really pedantic listeners out there, I will go ahead and preemptively note that, no, The Muppet Movie couldn't really be a chaser to Apocalypse Now. Came out, I think, 2 months before it, earlier in the summer, did follow a month later, Alien. My number four is The Summer from the movie year. We devoted our first Best Year Ever series to, back in 2019, commemorating 20 years of this great cinematic year. Yes, it is 1999. The case against 99 would be that it's not a particularly deep summer outside of the top five. I'll get to in a second. You've got South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. Fan of that. You've got John Sayles and Limbo. Also enjoy that film with David Strathairn. And Notting Hill. Hugh Grant, Julia Roberts is fine. I also know there is a fair amount of love out there for both Bowfinger and Dick. In terms of the big summer tentpole movies, though, Josh, the movies that should have defined the summer of 99, it's a bunch of films that I still haven't bothered to catch up with, did see and don't really care about, or did see and really didn't care for. It's movies like Wild Wild West and The Mummy and Tarzan and Deep Blue Sea, American Pie, even Adam Sandler's Big Daddy. If you look at the three highest grossing films of the year, one of them is in my top five. The other two, Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, that was a lackluster sequel. And speaking of lackluster sequels, Josh, no Star Wars Episode One, The Phantom Menace. While the movie we were all most highly anticipating back in 99, it's not going to make the movie poster. What is going to make the movie poster are five movies that helped spur this year to number three on my list of the best movie years ever back in 2017 when we did that top five. Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick, of course, Kidman, Cruise, and then you've got two horror films, both of which we know how much of a fan you are, The Sixth Sense, M. Night Shyamalan, and The Blair Witch Project, two movies that had everybody talking that summer, talking about the twist, whether they saw it coming, trying not to ruin it for people, and the film that, as we've talked about a little bit here on the show when we did our 9 from 99 review of Blair Witch, people weren't sure if it was real, if it was really all a hoax, whatever it was, the marketing around that film was very effective. And then we both feel strongly that it lived up to that marketing.
The search of the three missing Montgomery College students continues in Frederick County tonight.
10 days and thousands of man hours have been unable to produce any clues.
We have a few leads, a few other options we want to take advantage of and just try to put together some pieces to this puzzle.
Do you believe the occult may be involved in the disappearance of your son?
I am so scared.
How about The Iron Giant? Brad Bird, mm-hmm, setting the table for his amazing Pixar work, a great animated film from that year. And I'd round out the top five with Tom Tykwer's pumping high concept thriller that was probably a gateway art house film for a lot of cinephiles back in 1999, Run Lola Run.
Talk about stealing my thunder, Adam. You went right out and grabbed my number one.
Yeah.
And
maybe this should have been a joint list.
It is an incredible, incredible lineup. And I think why I have this at number one, even as you're listing those titles, I can picture the theaters that I went to for the top three, which I would say are The Blair Witch Project, The Sixth Sense, and Eyes Wide Shut. As you, mm-hmm, said, the expectations, what you did know about it. In the case of Kubrick, just knowing that this was a master with a late career effort, and then all of the buzz surrounding Blair Witch Project and Sixth Sense. So if you're talking about, and The Phantom Menace, I mean, which I, as you know, still appreciate, but I remember thinking about that and anticipating that. This was just, it felt like a momentous summer at the time, and it has stood the test of time to remain a momentous summer in retrospect. Maybe not in all the ways we expected, some ways that surprised us. I think something like The Iron Giant was a surprise. Sixth Sense, obviously a surprise. And, you know, Blair Witch Project, a surprise. But yeah, people have been talking about it since Sundance that year. So yes, it's the experience of being able to put myself, and maybe this isn't a fair way to evaluate this, because obviously I couldn't do this for the 70s, and I couldn't do it really as much for the early 80s, at least. The 90s, totally there, and this summer, totally hit. Keep in mind, too, when you talk about The Blair Witch Project, I've got that as my number two horror film of all time. That same list, Sixth Sense is number eight. So this, for me, as I'm giving it, you know, the subtitle is The Summer of Horror, just with those two movies on it. And as I'm looking at my 1999 top 10 list, so compiled at the time, I've got Blair Witch, Sixth Sense, Eyes Wide Shut. Let's see what else here. I really love South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. Put that on my top 10. Put The Phantom Menace on my top 10. I think half of my top 10 for that year came out in the summer. So that's why I had to put 1999 right at the top of my list.
Talk about truly stealing your thunder. I spoiled your number one movie summer, Josh.
I don't know where to go from here.
Well, obviously, we both have good taste. We'll see how we do then with my number three movie summer. And as I was earlier bemoaning the lack of good options from the 2000s or 2010s, I've got 2015 as my number three movie summer. And here's another case like 99, where three of the bigger titles people might point to from that summer didn't mean much to me. Those being Avengers, Age of Ultron, Jurassic World, and Straight Outta Compton, which certainly had its redeeming facets, though it was a film that I felt ultimately couldn't overcome some of the pitfalls of that type of biopic. Outside of that, though, Josh, there really is a lot of depth here. You've got, in the movie poster, Mad Max Fury Road, Ex Machina from Alex Garland, Inside Out. We just talked about it last week on the show in our Pixar poll question. Amy, one of my favorite documentaries from that year. Maybe a weird choice to have in the movie poster, but that's how much I liked it. And there's a lot of competition for these last two spots. I've got Amy and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, but you could throw in Magic Mike XXL as well. That movie, and actually Magic Mike was just on last night, flipping channels for a little bit. Magic Mike XXL is another one that seems to be on kind of HBO just every so often as I'm flipping channels. And both films are undeniably rewatchable. I get caught up in them every time. It's just kind of background movies if you're a little bit distracted, but also you find yourself getting caught up in them every time. And if those titles aren't enough, there were a bunch of smaller films from that year that I think we were positive on all of them, Josh, at least the ones we both reviewed. Noah Baumbach's Mistress America, great collaboration with Greta Gerwig there as the writer, co-writer with Baumbach. He directed it. Love and Mercy, the biopic-ish movie about Brian Wilson. End of the Tour, the biopic-ish movie about David Foster Wallace. We saw Joshua Oppenheimer's follow-up to The Act of Killing, The Look of Silence. And yeah, I can't believe it's taken me this long to get there. How about Pitch Perfect 2? And I know people are screaming right now at their listening devices, Josh, because I've talked about how great the summer of 2015 is, and I haven't even mentioned the movie that surely had to be the biggest movie of the summer, at least second to Age of Ultron. And it's the film that did compel the two of us to take the plunge and actually immerse ourselves in the Fast and Furious series.
Like it or not, you and your friends are a part of it now.
I don't have friends. I got family.
Furious 7, one of the better entries in that series or saga, whatever you want to call it. I haven't even mentioned another film I know you like even a little bit more than me, and that's the Amy Schumer comedy, Trainwreck,
yeah,
which is very good. So a lot of films from 2015, I think, to justify this pick, but especially when you look at those top three, Fury Road, Ex Machina, and Inside Out. I don't know if you ever have this happen to you, Josh. I was sure that those three films all made my top 10 films of 2015. I would tell people that those three movies are not only three of the best films of that year, they're three of the best films of that entire decade. And I went back and looked at my list. Somehow, you've got Inside Out at number four, which I know you like the film. Obviously, I just think of myself as even loving it more. And somehow it wasn't in my top 10 that year. Does that ever happen to you where you're like, I know this is in my top 10. Surely it is.
Oh, yeah.
And you look back and it's not there.
Oh yeah, of course. I've got some crazy stuff on my top 10s. When you go back, 2015 though holds up pretty well for me. And it's why I did consider this year. Trainwreck was on that top 10 as well. But then the big ones you just mentioned, Inside Out, Fury Road, Ex Machina, my favorite movie of that year. Was mm-hmm. Was it your number one that year as
I
well?
I think it was my number two.
Your number two. Okay.
It was one or two.
Yeah. So if it's my number one, I had to give 2015 some consideration, but didn't make the cut, however.
Answer me this. How do you feel about her?
Her AI is beyond doubt.
No, nothing analytical. Just how do you feel?
I feel that she's amazing.
Good.
Do you want to be my friend?
There is plenty of summer left on the 2022 calendar, and still a few picks left on our favorite movie summer's top five. We'll finish up our lists when we come back, plus I'll have some thoughts on Lightyear and Elvis. Stay with us.
If you're looking for trouble, you came to the right place. If you're looking for trouble, just look right in my face. I was born standing up and talking back. My daddy was a green-eyed mountain dad because I'm evil. My middle name is Misery.
He's a young singer from Memphis, Tennessee. Give him a warm hayride welcome. Mr. Elvis Presley.
That's from the trailer for Elvis, directed by Baz Luhrmann. Of course, the Australian impresario who gave us Romeo and Juliet in 96, 2001's Moulin Rouge, The Great Gatsby in 2013. I notice our producer Sam didn't list Australia there in his credits. It's been almost 10 years since we've had something new from Luhrmann. And based on the trailers, Josh, it appears to be a biopic in the traditional birth-to-death mold, but Luhrmann doesn't really do anything in a traditional way, and that, for the most part, has worked for you over the course of his career. You are a Baz Luhrmann defender. Does Elvis help make your case or hurt it?
First off, Adam, I'm going to absolve you of any association with what's about to happen, because I can hear the resignation in your voice.
Uh-huh.
I see you're getting a little nervous that people are gonna start saying things like, did Elvis really get a positive review on Film Spotting? And then they're gonna think maybe it was you, and this
right.
is just gonna give you night sweats.
Can't
so
have
I'm making it official. You have nothing to do with this, but I am recommending
oh, man.
Elvis.
Okay.
This was quite the experience. Primarily to the good. There are some significant issues, which I will get to. But man, was it fun to be in a Luhrmann movie, this maximalist, over-the-top, insane style. You know if you don't like it, stay far away, right? It's just don't even bother. But if you are a fan of this, it was sort of a welcome return. There's an early scene that is in a carnival funhouse, and that's what the whole movie felt like. It was just rocketing through a funhouse with all of these colors, the design you would expect. The costuming is fantastic. The makeup, Elvis, even when he's young, you know, and just this guy on the sideshow circuit is wearing like heavy eye makeup and lipstick. It is all out, all Luhrmann, and it was fantastic. And the other thing that really made this work, which I did not expect at all, this was the sort of stuff I thought, having seen the trailer, I might be able to get into this. Reticence about music biopics notwithstanding, if it's going to be another Luhrmann experience, I might be able to get into this. I had no expectations for Austin Butler, who plays Presley. He is incredible. Just incredible, Adam. The concert scenes are electric. It's almost as if he's been possessed by Presley. The voice is good enough. I'm sure there are bigger fans of Presley who will have quibbles, but it worked for me. It's the gyrations that he nails and the like mania behind them. I mean, it is almost as if the spirit of Elvis has possessed this guy in terms of the movements. And the camera, of course, Luhrmann's camera is just swooning beneath these reverberations. So the concert scenes, and there are plenty of them, maybe four or five significant ones, are an absolute thrill. Now, why is this a mild recommendation? I don't know what Tom Hanks was thinking. I don't know what motivated him to take this part as Colonel Tom Parker. It's not only the prosthetics, which are very Jabba the Hutt-esque, but it's the weird framing device where he bookends the movie on his deathbed, and at times he's like the unreliable narrator, but then there will be long segments where it's just following Butler's Elvis and they forget about Parker. So there's no consistency to that. It could have been an intriguing way to frame Elvis's life, but they don't commit to it. And Hanks is just helpless underneath these prosthetics and the accent too. I mean, it's one of these, like, I just kind of default to Transylvania because I don't know what it is or where it's going. So that's kind of where he ends up.
There are some who'd make me out to be the villain of this here story.
Maybe more troubling, and this is the one, if people really take issue with this, I'll be like, yeah, I can see that. It's a really bizarre way they tackle this idea of Elvis being an appropriator of Black tradition and music, right? That's always been part of the conversation, makes Elvis a very complicated figure. To what point was he honoring that tradition? To what point did he just borrow those things? And because he was a white guy, it rocketed him to fame and not others. The movie's answer to that is to essentially paint this Elvis as an activist, like a civil rights activist, in some very awkward ways. It intercuts one of his scenes where he's a censor is going to shut the concert down if he does anything lewd, and he just kind of goes nuts, like the pelvis comes out like crazy. And then Lerman intercuts that with scenes of a segregationist politician's speech at a rally to kind of say, because Elvis is thrusting his hips, he's like fighting against
a revolutionary.
He's a revolutionary. And there are a lot of awkward moments like that. He's watching Dr. Martin Luther King's memorial service on TV and crying, and segues quickly into a conversation about his career. That's just kind of icky. So that stuff, I think, is not well handled at all. And, you know, might trouble others more than it does me. I am not an Elvis historian or a music historian, so I don't know if any of that is anywhere close to the truth. I just know this is a really complicated area of Elvis's legacy, and I don't know that the movie handles that all that well. But for Butler, for the Lerman of it, I am going to give it a mild recommendation.
Okay. If that mild recommendation makes you inclined to want to see Elvis for yourself, as we're recording, Josh, we still have some passes available. Filmspotting.net. Look right at the top of the page. Giveaway. You can win a Fandango pass to see Elvis for free as it hits theaters here starting June 24th. You've been a busy boy. You also caught up with Pixar's Lightyear. We are told that in 1995, Andy saw Lightyear, and it was his favorite movie. He got the toy, and that is what gave us those four films that most of us have come to know and love. Would Lightyear have been your favorite movie back in 95, Josh?
It wouldn't. Would it have been my favorite movie in 85 when I was, you know, 11? Probably not my favorite. I would have been a little bit more into it, but all of that is neither here nor there. I'll keep this brief because I did go a little long on Elvis. Probably the best way to think about Lightyear, which I did like as well, primarily for just the exquisite animation, which seems pointless to say, but we've kind of stopped saying it about Pixar because it becomes taken for granted. And I think it particularly becomes taken for granted when you're dealing with something that is seen as a reheat, you know, a sequel or something like that. It's like, yeah, so it looks good. We expected that. This thing looks fantastic. Looks really, really good. There's some humor to it, especially with this supporting character of Sox, an animatronic AI cat. But really, this is mid-tier Pixar. What I would say, instead of saying it's mid-tier Pixar is maybe more helpful, is among the reheats, so among the sequels, I would say, aside from the Toy Story proper sequels, this is their best. So I definitely put it above the Cars sequels. I'd put it above Monsters University. I'd put it above Finding Dory. That may be, you know, faint praise for some people, but it'll give you some idea of where it lands in that tier of Pixar efforts. It could have been a lot worse. There are some things to recommend it. I do wish Pixar would put their resources and energy towards their original ideas, because as we've seen even this year from something like Turning Red, that's where the really special stuff gets done.
Lightyear is currently playing in wide release. If you see it or Elvis and have any comments, we would love to hear from you. Feedback at filmspotting.net. Next week here on Film Spotting, we're going to kick off our 6-part Barbara Stanwyck marathon. Stanwyck, of course, one of the great actresses from the golden age of Hollywood, adept in comedies, dramas, cynical noirs, probably her best known film, Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. But then she's also known for her work in comedies like Preston Sturges's The Lady Eve and Howard Hawks Ball of Fire. Those three films are all in our marathon. We're going to start, though, with her Pre-Code work, 1933's Babyface, a blind spot for both of us. It's a film that sees Stanwyck's Lily Powers tire of being exploited by men, so she decides to do a little exploiting herself. Long been meaning to catch up with this film and am eager for the marathon to commence. We hope you'll follow along. It's available as a digital rental on most platforms. You also may find it at your local library or through interlibrary loan. You can find the complete marathon lineup at filmspotting.net/marathons.
Also at filmspotting.net, you can vote in the current film spotting poll, which is inspired by the decade that Stanwyck came to fame, the 1930s. We're asking, what is your favorite 1930s film starring an iconic actor-actress duo? We had some conversation, Adam, about whether or not we're going to vote for the film in this scenario, vote for the duo. I guess we'll leave that up to listeners to decide as they look at our options. Again, you can vote for the poll at filmspotting.net. And if you have thoughts on Stanwyck or Babyface in particular, send a note or an MP3 to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave a message at 312-264-0744, and we might just use it on next week's show.
We did prescribe in the wording of the poll that it's the film that should be your choice, but how much will the iconic actor-actress duo actually impact your choice or sway your pick? If you vote now at filmspotting.net, your vote could matter, Josh, because we've got a very tight race for the top spot. Bringing Up Baby, currently leading Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, edging out Myrna Loy and William Powell in The Thin Man. And there's also a tight race for fourth place, just one or two votes separating Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn, The Adventures of Robin Hood, and Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers in Top Hat. Again, you can vote now at filmspotting.net. We did want to take a moment to acknowledge the passing of a French acting legend, Jean-Louis Trintignant. He died over the weekend, 92 years old, Josh, and most listeners, if the name doesn't immediately ring a bell, will probably think of him as one of the co-leads in Michael Haneke's Amour from the past decade, but he was also in Krzysztof Kieslowski's Red. He was a Best Actor winner at Cannes in 1969 for a movie that we both, I believe, need to see some homework before, Film Spotting Madness, 1960s. That's Z. And another film on that list from 69, Eric Rohmer's My Night at Maud's. He was also in And God Created Women, the Roger Vadim film with Brigitte Bardot. But the one I'll always think of him the most fondly for, and really one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to mention his passing on the show, Bernardo Bertolucci's The Conformist, is just an all-time great Italian film with a wonderful performance from Jean-Louis Trintignant.
Well, and when I think of him in Amour, it's almost one of those performances that is hard to separate from his co-lead, Emmanuel Riva, mm-hmm. as this aging couple, and he, as she has health issues, has to take on care for her. They're just so great together. And it's also, in terms of his performance too, you think of her going through this transition with the fading health, but it's remarkable how he does the same. Even though he stays in better health, it's this emotional heaviness and fading that you witness on his face. We talk about these physical performances so often mm-hmm. that get a lot of attention, where an actor will morph their body in a certain way, and somehow Trintignant does that alongside Riva, even though it's not as showy as we normally would associate, but you just feel not the years passing in that performance, but the minutes as that movie goes on. He's just incredible in it.
Qu'est-ce qui se passe? Qu'est-ce qu'il y a? Han. Coucou. C'est moi. Han. Qu'est-ce qui se passe? Han.
All right, let's play a little Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance to win a Film Spotting t-shirt. A couple weeks ago, we massacred this scene.
What are you doing? Stop it! Stop it! Give me those pictures. You can't photograph people like that.
Who says I can't? I'm only doing my job. Some people are bullfighters, some people are politicians. I'm a photographer.
This is a public place. Everyone has the right to be left in peace.
It's not my fault if there's no peace. You know, most girls would pay me to photograph them.
I'll pay you.
That was Vanessa Redgrave and David Hemmings in 1966's Blow Up. It was written by Julio Cortazar, Tonino Guerra, Edward Bond, and Michelangelo Antonioni, directed by Antonioni. That massacre was part of a show a couple weeks back when we shared the audio from our recent live event in Chicago with guest Dana Stevens. That featured a conversation about Buster Keaton's Cameraman and our Keaton Marathon Awards. Also on that show, our top five films of the year so far. So why that scene from Blow Up?
Here's John Bentley Smith in Cambridge, UK. Many times have I listened to Massacre Theater and thought, I should know what that is, and then kicked myself when the answer came around. So I surprised myself when I recognized this week's entry. The film was Blow Up, though I'm afraid that in terms of ties to the rest of the show, I can't stretch any further than the obvious fact that its protagonist is, like the title of the Keaton film you screened, a cameraman. Well, stretch no further, John. To my shame, I have not seen the last entry in your marathon, something I really must rectify, especially since I adored Sherlock Jr. Anyway, love the show, guys, and loved having Dana on that last episode. Keep on at it.
Thanks, John. Here's Ian Mullen from Portland, Oregon. I was unable to hear the clue later in the show due to a loose oil pan plug in my car. It is a long story. Okay, we believe you, Ian. But when I was younger, there were very few resources to see footage of an early favorite band, the Yardbirds. Not only did Blow Up feature the band, it was one of the rare instances of Beck and Page performing together on film. A high school friend and I watched the movie often.
Love the historical perspective. Thank you, Ian. Josh, reach into that film spotting hat that I would not describe as brimming. I don't think there are enough Ian and Johns in the world who have seen this Antonioni classic. So you had a good shot at winning if you entered.
Well, maybe it was only John, Ian, and Josh in Cedar Park, Texas who entered.
Not quite.
But
not
Josh, quite. Josh took it. So congratulations.
All you have to do, Josh, is email feedback@filmspotting.net and we will set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
Broadsheet journalists have described my impressions as stunningly accurate.
Well, they're wrong. I've not heard your Michael Caine, but I assume it would be something along the lines of,
my name's Michael Caine.
That is where you are so wrong.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and look, we're not going to disguise the fact that this choice of scene was clearly inspired by Josh seeing Baz Luhrmann's Elvis and recommending it just a short time ago here on Film Spotting. And since you were most recently in contact with Austin Butler's Possessed performance, we're going to see if the spirit can work its way into you, Josh.
Oh, boy. I have not been this nervous for a Massacre Theater performance in quite some time, because I feel like the way I thought is this should be easy. You would think this would be easy to do. And then I started in my head trying to sound it out, and I think it's harder than people might think. So I'm going to give myself that excuse in advance.
Okay. Well, it's going to be fun, at least for me as a spectator and sort of participant here as we go. All you got to do is identify the scene, and you could win a Film Spotting t-shirt. Tell us what movie it's from. We've already helped you out. You can start eliminating titles just based on the hints we've given. I'd ask you if you're ready, but I know you're not.
No, let's just do it. I'm going to give you the action. And okay. Action.
Dang, Elvis Presley. You didn't have to rile him up like that.
What now?
Nah, I'm just...
Excuse me, what?
I'm just saying, we got to follow that, and...
Well, sometimes you got to go half a way. You're the king, and you can't help it, you know? Because there's only one man who's the king. God picks him, hand plucks him. One night God looked down over millions and millions and millions of people, man. He decided which one was the best, and it was me. And he plucked me from those millions and millions and millions of people, man.
Yeah.
Listen to this right now. There's two things you need to know. I'm the king. And number two is, look out, man. Look at that, just coming at you. See that? It's called karate, man. And only two kinds of people know it. Johnny's and the king. And one of them is me.
You're the king. And scene.
Not so sure about that. Not so sure I'm the king.
I'm going to call it impressive.
Okay.
Impressive enough. I felt it move through you.
People might.
Just enough.
People might know who I was playing.
Indeed, they might. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, July 4th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. Yeah!
It's too bumpy. We'll have to walk from here!
As we get back into our top five movie summers, we should probably note that things got a little out of order. Adam spoiled my number one pick by listing it earlier in his list. So to recap here, at number five, I had 2008. At number four, I had 1979. And then, yes, the number one year for me was 1999, which Adam already had on his list.
Yeah, folks, we've discovered that maybe this is a top five list we should have talk to each other a little bit more about, because there's significant overlap. Josh said his number four was 1979. It was my number five. My number four, yes, was his number one. I had 1999. And then finally, a point of divergence, 2015, my number three choice did not make your list, Josh. So you've got two more picks to get to. You're 3-2. This is where math comes in and where math gets annoying. You have your number three and number two left. I've got my number two and number one, and it turns out we share those same movie years, just in a slightly different order. We heard a clip from E.T. Tell us why 82 is your number two.
Well, because it's the summer of Spielberg. That's the subtitle I gave this, which people may be wondering why. Wasn't E.T. the only Spielberg film that came out that summer? Well, he had a pretty heavy hand involved in Poltergeist, which is a horror film that has made my top 10 horror films of all time list. I think I've got it number nine there. And yes, Spielberg was a producer. It feels very much like a dark Spielberg film. The credited director, Toby Hooper, all sorts of production stories about how heavily Spielberg was involved in that. Whatever the case, it's a really incredible horror film, and one of the reasons I have 1982 as my number three movie summer here, Spielberg's touch. Let's go back to E.T., though, my favorite Spielberg film. In my 2012 Sight and Sound Inspired Top 20 of All Time list, it makes that bottom 10 group. Also, we've already talked about Fury Road, Adam, in 2015, one of the summers you picked. How about Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior?
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say which is better in terms of a George Miller movie, Fury Road or Road Warrior. If I were ever forced to pick, that would be incredibly tough. I love Mad Max too. You also have just a little movie called Blade Runner coming out in 1982. I'm a big fan of Tron. It might be a while before others who look at this summer get to Tron, if they get to it at all. But I think that's one of the best films of that summer. And then we've talked about how comedies are crucial to have as part of the mix here in your favorite movie summers. You've got a great one with Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, Mr. Hand, what's the reason for your truancy?
Just couldn't make it on time.
You mean you couldn't or you wouldn't?
Well, it's like a full crowd scene at the food line.
Food will be eaten on your time. Why are you continuously late for this class, Mr. Spicoli? Why do you shamelessly waste my time like this?
I don't know.
Jay Skowski on the Larson on Film Facebook page, he dropped this comment. Simply, the summer of 82 made me a movie lover. We've talked about which summers are the formative years for us. 82 was one for Jace. A couple of titles that are highly rated by others, maybe not so high by me, but The Thing, An Officer and a Gentleman, those both came out in 82. So a significant movie summer for me, and I've got it at number three.
Yeah, significant and so good. I stole your thunder. Now you're returning the favor. 1982 is, in fact, my number one movie summer. Yeah, it's number one. And you really did list all the titles, but
Officer
again,
and a Gentleman,
to,
put it over the top for you.
Hey, you kid, it's part of the reason why I think 82 is such a good movie year. No, it's not in the movie poster. The top five for that year looks something like this to me. Blade Runner, E.T., The Thing, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And then here is where we really get into what makes 82 so deep. You could have any number of films, at least five or six, contending for that fifth spot. And everybody listening might have a different answer. You could go Poltergeist. You could go An Officer and a Gentleman. You could go with Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, one of three big sequels from that summer. I noticed, Josh, that you skipped two movies that you don't care for, but are pretty great. And I loved them when I was a kid in the early 80s, and I still think they're very good now. Rocky 3 and Star Trek 2. Give it to me. Give me a little Khan.
Oh, that's Shatner, right. Josh. I saw that and I was
like, Wrath of Khan.
Do I even want to put this on my list? Because then I have to deal with Khan.
Yeah, I think you do have to deal with Khan, and it belongs as part of the conversation. Also, folks wanting their kind of boomer nostalgia fix that year, Diner came out in early May.
Yep.
But I have yet to list the film that actually for me would be in the top five. I know a lot of people overlook it. This is my particular hill to die on. One of my all-time favorite movies happens to be the George Roy Hill film starring Robin Williams and Glenn Close, The World According to Garp. That was also 82. So maybe tough to put that in the top five when you're talking about movies like Blade Runner, E.T., The Thing, Fast Times, and Poltergeist, but it would be in the poster for me. And you were talking about your year 99 as the horror year. And certainly I wouldn't describe E.T. as a horror movie or Blade Runner, but it's interesting to see those three titles together and think of them kind of as three varying takes on the creature feature. You know, three movies that really explore this idea of the other, whether it's The Thing from Another World in The Thing from Another World that's benevolent in E.T., or these replicants, these things that are just like us. They take the form of us, not unlike that creature in The Thing. And that's a film I know you're not as big a fan of, Josh, that Carpenter film, but just speaking to something primal about human nature, the nature of human nature, the notion of fear itself, about survival, about paranoia, and Fast Times, the seminal teen sex comedy that really created the blueprint, for better or worse, for so many films that followed throughout that decade. And I'm talking about horror movies. I imagine seeing Fast Times at Ridgemont High for a lot of parents in the early 80s was a kind of horror experience, right? Oh, that's what our kids are up to? I really didn't need to know that. And of course, Poltergeist, the movie that then was about those parents, that 60s so generation parents now reckoning with some of the decisions that they're making later in their life. That's a film that still absolutely holds up. And you joke about An Officer and a Gentleman. I've always been a fan of that film. The movie that everybody's parents, if you were a kid like us back then, it's probably the film that everybody's parents went to see, that kind of prestige, quote unquote, adult film. Your dad was probably seeing it because it was about the military. Your mom was probably seeing it because it had Richard Gere in it looking so good in those naval whites. Louis Gossett Jr. giving a performance that went on to be awarded Best Supporting Actor, the first black actor ever to win that award.
I done some checking. I looked through your files. I know about your mama. They don't eyeball me. I know your father's an alcoholic and a chaser. That's why you don't mesh, Mayo. Because deep down inside, don't you eyeball me. Deep down inside, you know that all these other boys and girls are better than you are. Isn't that right, Mayo? Huh? Isn't that right? No, sir! No, sir!
We've mentioned like 12 films, Josh, that came out alone in the summer of 82 that are all still worth seeing and worth discussing, and that's why it's my number one.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible to think about that all being packed into just a couple of months, isn't it? I don't know if, do we get that with the world of streaming nowadays? We probably get just as much in terms of quantity of the content, but yeah, that is a ton of good stuff. So number one for you, number three for me.
Yeah.
Which means I'm moving on to my number two, and this is where I was really struggling with the question of, Is it the poster approach? Do you want, you know, quantity essentially, although all quality as well? Or could there be one film that is just so towering, you almost have to reckon with the summer because that one film came out, as long as the rest of the season wasn't a dud.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what 1989 was for me. It was the summer of an all-timer. It's when we got Do the Right Thing. The only film of any of these we've discussed, I talked about how we did that Sight and Sound inspired top 10 of all time back in 2012. Do the Right Thing was on my top 10 at that point. And so it's just in a different stratosphere than any other movie we've talked about. And it came out in the summer of 1989. Okay, so I've got to take this summer seriously. What else came out that might actually not only land it at this list, but put it pretty high up, if not number one, number two, where I've got it? Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I think we both consider that not just an Indiana Jones sequel, but really in its own right, an incredible adventure film.
Mm-hmm.
Dead Poets Society, which we've revisited together, Adam, on the show and thought held up. Similarly, could say the same thing about Batman, Tim Burton's Batman. Hugely appreciated that on a revisit. And then you have a couple here that some people might not like as much. Some people might rank as highly as the ones I just said. When Harry Met Sally, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, the announcement of Steven Soderbergh. And for me, James Cameron's The Abyss. I love The Abyss, a hugely underrated Cameron movie. And maybe that's just because he's made other films that have become these box office and cultural juggernauts. And I know there is affection for The Abyss out there, but I would actually put The Abyss right up there with some of his most acclaimed films. So for me, 1989 had to be at number two. Had a couple of listeners give support on social media. Greg Milliken on Twitter, he's at MyTweetLord. Most memorable summer ever at the movies. And then Rich Starnes on Facebook. I don't know how much I factored this in, but he offered this up. Weekend at Bernie's. Always vote for Weekend at Bernie's. If you say so, I mean, Rich.
I did laugh quite a bit at Weekend at Bernie's back in 99. I'm not going to lie. The sequel, not so much. Josh, I'm sorry. Where in that litany was Roadhouse?
Oh, have I seen Roadhouse?
Oh, man. If you haven't, that's our next live show.
I know. I would love nothing more, and I think that would be a great choice.
Yeah, maybe more apropos for our friends at the Blank Check podcast to watch Roadhouse versus us. But, you know, it's a movie that I do remember with a lot of affection from 1989. No, it's not on the movie poster. Josh, you almost nailed it. Here we are sharing another pick, and we're even sharing the same slot. For me, it really came down to 89 versus 82. And even though we agree 99 is obviously a great year, made both of our lists, these two were in a tier all by themselves. And it's that poster. You had them in almost the exact same order as me. Do the Right Thing, Last Crusade, Dead Poets Society, Batman. And then for me, instead of Abyss or When Harry Met Sally ahead of Sex, Lies, and Videotape, I've got the Soderbergh in that fifth slot, followed by The Abyss and the Rob Reiner comedy classic with Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan. A big movie that summer, too, that maybe no one's going to go back and need to rewatch. Lethal Weapon 2 was a big hit. Vampire's Kiss, the Nicolas Cage movie that I still need to see, came out in 89. And maybe we won't talk too much about Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. Josh?
Final Frontier, I think that's the one I like.
That's probably the one you like, which would make total sense. But we don't need to extol the virtues of these films. It's just the variety, though, encompassed in those five. You've got Soderbergh really setting the indie world on fire with Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Me in 89, the aspiring but not quite college English major, seeing something like Dead Poets Society and having my world set on fire. Batman, the defining comic book film, certainly of our childhoods, and really, and certainly a superhero film, the defining film until we started to get all those MCU movies, of course, much later. And Indiana Jones, feeling at the time, you know, I wasn't a big fan of Temple of Doom when it came out in 84. And I still, of course, had that deep appreciation for Raiders of the Lost Ark. But I remember coming to The Last Crusade kind of thinking, is this Spielberg just trying to reheat the magic a little bit? Is this film really gonna deliver on its own terms? And we've talked about it here on the show, having seen it recently, fairly recently, not only with my kids on DVD, but then also seeing it at the Music Box with a big crowd. It was a magical experience. And for me, one of my favorite Spielberg films, not too far behind Raiders of the Lost Ark and Do the Right Thing, a movie I don't think I saw in 89, Josh. I was still in a place and time, maybe not quite, I've said this before, maybe not quite at that point as sophisticated a cinephile as you. I was 1 or 2 years away still from really getting into it. And in small town Iowa, we weren't getting Do the Right Thing at the single theater cinema. I certainly at that age wasn't able to drive to Des Moines and see that film either. And as we're thinking about movie summers, and we kind of started off talking a little bit about a summer like 79 and what it would have been like to see Apocalypse Now in the theater for the first time or see Alien back in 79. Do the Right Thing is also one of those time capsule movies.
Sure.
Where you really do wonder what it would have been like, how incendiary it would have been, how revolutionary it would have felt at the time. And then add to it, what if I could have seen it in my little small town Iowa cinema? What would the reaction to that film have been? It's something that will only have to be a fantasy, Josh, but 89, certainly not just one of the best movie summers ever, but the second choice on my list that I also had as one of my favorite movie years ever.
Hey, Sal, I'm getting a brother for the war here.
You want brothers on the wall?
Love.
Get your own place. You can do what you want to do.
89, the number. Another summer.
What'd I tell you about that noise?
What'd I tell you about that picture?
So I did a little research, Adam, on my website, and indeed, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, it's one of the rare good Star Trek movies. So I think that's it. I've got to bump 89 up to number one now, given that.
You're incorrigible. Those are our top five movie summers. We would love to hear your picks or any other comments about the show. Feedback at filmspotting.net. Did you have some honorable mentions, Josh, that you want to fit in?
I did give consideration, as I mentioned, to one of your picks, 2015. And then the other 2 years that I thought about were 1991, quickly, Thelma and Louise, Jungle Fever, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, Boys in the Hood. Those were the movies that really made me give that year some consideration. And then how about 2002? We just revisited Sam Raimi's Spider-Man recently. Really strong film, held up for us. You had Shyamalan again with Signs, Spielberg with Minority Report. Lilo and Stitch is a Disney movie that I really like. The Bourne Identity, and then About a Boy. I think those were the strong films. Of course, I'm a fan of Attack of the Clones. I love the prequels.
I know you are.
So you know that works for me. So those were the other 2 years I did think about, 1991 and 2002.
Well, making your case further for 1991, I believe that not only did you not give proper recognition to Roadhouse earlier, but you did not call out Point Break either.
And that's
Patrick
right.
Swayze magic from 1991. Mentioned it earlier, 2008 from your list, one I considered. Going back to the original, the one that started it all, that movie poster for 1975 starts with Jaws, is followed by Dog Day Afternoon, and then you throw Robert Altman's Nashville on it.
Yep.
From there, the esteem maybe drops, but that is a formidable trio. You've got Woody's Love and Death. You've got Cooley High, a movie we both like quite a bit. Also one I still somehow have never seen, but we all know that in movie theaters across the country at midnight, people are still watching the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I mentioned off the top that 7 of my 12 that I was considering or something were from the 80s. I will not run through them all, but I think you just can look back at every year, 84 up to 88, you can make a case for. And I think the only one I'll single out here, Josh, that is the purest shot of nostalgia, just when you look at the list, it's 84. Another one of those years that a lot of people consider one of the best movie years ever. This is the summer that gave us Ghostbusters, The Karate Kid, Revenge of the Nerds, 16 Candles, Gremlins, Red Dawn, another Swayze pick, The Last Starfighter, of course, Prince and Purple Rain. I didn't see The Neverending Story, but a lot of people loved it in 84. And I've left out two films that I don't like that much, The Temple of Doom and Once Upon a Time in America. 84 is the year I couldn't justify on my list because I don't know that I could look a lot of listeners in the eye and say that outside of nostalgia, all or even most of these films hold up. But it's the one I really have to highlight here, Josh, because I don't know how I could explain to someone who wasn't a kid in 84 what it was like. Just the endless parade of going to the theater and seeing these films and then rewatching them and rewatching them and rewatching them on HBO.
Yeah, you just named my neighbor friends at their house their entire VHS collection.
Yep.
With those titles, pretty much.
Star Wars, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Sound of Music. In the tradition of these great films about fighting back against the odds, 20th Century Fox presents another milestone in motion picture history. Revenge of the Nerds.
Nerds!
Again, our top five movie summers, and we would love to hear your favorite summer. Just email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. That's our show, Josh.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, you can find Adam at Film Spotting and I'm at Larson on Film. We had all kinds of good comments and suggestions that were a lot of fun to read for this top five, so thank you for that. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005, and you can vote in the current Film Spotting poll, which has us looking ahead to our upcoming Barbara Stanwyck Marathon, which starts with one of her early 1930s films. So we're asking, what is your favorite 1930s film starring an iconic actor-actress duo? To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out on digital this weekend, Rise. This is the Giannis biopic. Josh, I'll let you say Giannis's last name. You're so good at these long last names.
Rastakun. Oh, no, that's someone else. Atanakumpo.
I'd like to see that film. That's on Disney Plus. Also, Flux Gourmet, the new one from Peter Strickland, who gave us The Duke of Burgundy and Barbarian Sound System. In wide release, a horror film, Josh, that I wonder if you're going to make time for as you are writing a book on horror films. I usually avoid these films, but I'm intrigued because my guy Ethan Hawke is the grabber in The Black Phone, the new horror film from director Scott Derrickson, who directed Doctor Strange and Sinister.
Yeah, and he also made The Exorcism of Emily Rose, which I write about at length in the chapter on religious horror, so I'm definitely going to have to catch up with this one.
Even scarier than The Black Phone, though, is Elvis's possessed pelvis in Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, also out in wide release.
Don't exercise it. Please do not exercise that. Too enjoyable.
Next week, as you heard Josh say, the summer of Stanwyck starts with Babyface, and we'll have some more cinema hijinks here on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgeren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.